You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, August 13th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I am Michael Jamal Brooks.
And this is the award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal...
To tape.
Oh, yes, to tape. But we are in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City today.
That's
folks.
Right, folks. As you listen to this, I, Matthew Harrison Binder, am on a plane flying to Orlando, Florida, to be entertained by a person in a mouse costume. I am not going all the way to Florida to attend a Chuck E. Cheese restaurant. I am going to Walt Disney World. Michael, what are you doing on this fine Wednesday?
I will be celebrating my birthday. I am going to, and this is the absolute truth, I'm going with my girlfriend and many other friends to a steakhouse in Harlem to celebrate my birthday.
You already have that plan. Oh,
it's
Wednesday
all planned.
Is your birthday.
When is my birthday, my friend?
This is your birthday show.
This is my birthday show.
I mean, I know we're here Monday night recording this.
Yeah.
It's your birthday.
Yeah, it is.
Happy. We can't sing that song because of
happy pre-birthday.
Copyright.
Happy pre-birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Just changing it up a bit.
I understand. I appreciate that. So, yes, I'll be celebrating my birthday. I might be looking during the day, possibly at new office space for this show.
Ooh.
That's possible. Something we'll be talking about more in the future. But mainly, I will be celebrating my birthday, folks. But we have a show for you. No guest. Just some stories that are relevant today as we're recording this and going to be relevant as you're listening to this.
As Sam usually missays, I'm laughing.
Oh, my God.
The dulcet tones.
The dulcet tones.
But he usually says, almost every time I'm laughing thinking about it, he usually says dulcet tones before correcting himself and saying dulcet tones.
The dulcet tones of... Michael and Matt. I liked when he said, I liked when he introduced the first times we were subbing for him. I liked when he goes, and you hear from other people, like my friends. And then he goes, not that Michael and Matt are my friends. I'm cordial with them.
While we're talking about Sam, can we share with our listeners here as it's kind of like a, you know, a laid back Wednesday.
A little bit more of a laid back
it's
Wednesday.
It's a casual Wednesday.
It's definitely a casual
how Sam one time bought this gift card. To like a deli type place in the area, like it's what's called Gallant and Gallard or something like that.
Guy and Gallard. Yeah. You'll see them all if you live in New York.
It's like a
you
chain
see them
of
all
fancy
over the place.
Delis or whatever.
It's not even
not fancy, but like you know, it's not your corner bodega. Is what
yeah,
I'm saying.
Yeah, it's bare bones deli.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like apparently, if you bought the gift card, you got a little bit of extra money. Like say you got like you know you spend $25, you get a $30 gift card instead of a $25 gift card for $25. And so Sam got it, and literally, like, what is it, the next day or something?
The next day, this particular branch shut down, and they made Sam eat the card. And
there's no guy in God.
They're like, all the other ones are incredibly inconvenient. And I just,
this has been
literally one of the funnest things that's ever happened in the office.
We have this ongoing thing where this made-up fictional guy in Gallard, the franchisee of that store is just out to screw over Sam.
They're just like, oh, he bought the card. Time to move back to Nepal, everybody. In your face, Cedar.
And whenever something's happening to Sam, something bad's happening to him, where he's telling us about some story, about some inconvenient thing that happened to him, we always bring up this fictional Guy and Gaillard franchisee owner just happens to be behind this other thing. Like when Sam was telling the story about how he was trying to get Mila into this Hebrew school.
Right.
We made up this whole scenario where the Guy and Gaillard guy is actually one of the guys who runs this Hebrew school. And he's like, well, Sam, if you want to get her in, I'll give you a very special deal. And the next day, the Hebrew school is closed.
That's right. The Hebrew school is relocated.
It's one of my favorite things we do.
There really is, like, if we put a camera on this office, just letting you in on a little, like, of the MR process, there would be a lot of things that people would find, like, literally achingly funny. Like, people would have so much fun seeing some of the things that go down. Then there would be another third that would you just be like, oh, my God, that's boring. And then there would be another third where you would just be like, that's just appalling. That's just absolutely horrible that these guys do this stuff. I hope you recover from whatever this cough is over the vacation.
But I'm glad we started off this show laughing because, as we just said, we're recording this on Monday night. And we'll talk about this more at the end of the show. But it's Monday night, August 11th. And literally about an hour ago, we got the news that Robin Williams committed suicide. Very sad. We'll talk about this more, but I'm glad.
Yeah, I was out having a drink with a friend. I haven't seen her for a while.
And I was alone in the office, and waiting for Michael to come back from his partying.
Well, you know, you chose to start late, buddy.
But I feel like Robin Williams would want us to.
I believe he would, but she told me. But we had this nice catch up, and then I got back from the bathroom, and she said, "Hey, you know, Robin Williams just killed himself," and it was just sort of like just really sad. So obviously we will get to that. I'm sure people will be talking about this on Wednesday. But first, let's get to a few stories that I have lined up. Obviously, we're going to be running a lot shorter today because that's just what we're going to be doing. But some things that I think we ought to be talking about this week. And I want to start with, you know, I've noticed on comment boards and in response to some of how we've covered, and I want to disaggregate two things. There's the immigration crisis generally in this country, that we don't have a strategy and a policy to deal with immigration. And we know this, and this is pretty broadly acknowledged, that we need significant immigration reform. And it's even fairly broadly acknowledged that obviously, part of the reason we don't have it is because of xenophobia, of course. But this crisis of child refugees on the border who are flooding or are escaping just these horrific human rights crises, many of which are connected to U.S. policies in the region, I might add, has really shown and demonstrated the utterly just morally abhorrent and repugnant core of what really drives the anti-immigration hysteria of this country and the hypocrisy of it and the lack of any type of historical perspective. I mean, we know, look, basically in this country, you were here from the beginning if you were a Native American who was being exterminated, an African American who was being brought over as a slave, and potentially a white person who is doing either one or both of those things. Everybody else is a late arriver, okay? Like, I know a couple of generations ago, all my folks were in various parts of Europe, okay? And I know that I'm, you know, acceptable, obviously, now, being white. But let's not be under any illusion about the nature of this country. You know, a land of immigrants is not just a cliche, it's a reality. And the racism that is driving the opposition to helping children is not only having the effect of delaying and distorting the policy process in obscene ways, it's having an effect of actually revitalizing the Ku Klux Klan in certain parts of this country.
Oh, wonderful.
Now, you know, and this is a group that has been on the decline. Both because it's obviously antiquated, horrific terrorist organization. I think also because other groups that are more aggressive and have a little bit more, I mean, it's bizarre to say this, but maybe are more in tune with how to spread hate and terrorism and xenophobia in modern era have kind of picked up some of the slack. But according to some new reports that that Think Progress has sort of brought together from various news organizations, the Ku Klux Klan is zeroing in on anti-immigration hysteria as a means to which through which to bring people to their organization. So let's give a couple of examples. There was an event recently in North Carolina to drum up support against quote-unquote illegal immigration. Klan members did not give a speech at the rally. This is according to the article. Instead, opted to shout messages like white power and hate against, quote, mixed breeds. At the same time, Fox reported that immigration advocates counter-protested across and sang the gospel song Hallelujah. Moving forward, for over a month, the KKK has advertised in Troy, Raleigh, calling local residents to save our land, join the Klan. The rally drew between 400 and 500 immigration advocate counter-protesters. The Klan has also been active in various other parts of the country, including in South Carolina. According to a report by Al Jazeera, Klan members said the way to deal with the immigration crisis, which is a crisis in their view, one Klan member in North Carolina told Al Jazeera, quote, if we pop a couple of them off and leave the corpses lying on the border, maybe they'll see how serious we are about stopping immigrants. Mark Potok, the senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center, told the Orange County Register that the loyal white knights are trying to unite Americans around demonizing undocumented immigrants. The KKK is not the only extremist group to target immigrants this summer. More recently, right-wing militiamen took up the Texas-Mexico border to confront border crossers. There's a lot more quotes in the article, and I would suggest looking it up. But I just – we cannot distinguish these things anymore. And I'm not saying that there isn't a lot of complexities in the mechanics of how immigration reform gets done. But any time someone talks about flooding of immigrants, crossing our borders, disrupting our traditions, they need to be called directly for what they're doing. They are the handmaidens of a revitalized racist movement in this country. And if you combine the xenophobia with a stagnant economy, limited job prospects, and collapsed opportunity in parts of this country because of policies that favor the corporate sector, mass inequality, and austerity, you're building a profoundly dangerous formula. And it's no surprise to see this. And I still see people trying to disaggregate and defend the stunning xenophobia we see on display from leading Republican figures. And these steps ain't that big. And if you're out agitating against giving child refugees an opportunity to save their lives from getting raped and murdered by cartelmen, and if you don't think we should have a rational system to integrate people who are living here and paying taxes and working and operating businesses, you have to seriously confront why you would oppose that, and you have to realize that you are the direct conduit for a revitalization of one of the oldest terrorist organizations in the United States. And that's what the Ku Klux Klan is. I mean, this is not, you know, a hate group or an extremist group. You could call it all those things. It's a terrorist organization that targeted Americans and systemically raped, murdered, tortured, and engaged in acts of bombings and spectacular acts of terrorism. That's what it is. And if you are in any way feeding them, then you're part of a revitalized terrorist movement in America.
You mean it's got nothing to do with heritage?
Yeah, nothing. Nothing whatsoever. Nothing whatsoever. I mean, I don't – like the delusions people have
it
around
is
that issue is just it's astonishing.
Bizarre.
I mean, it's like people don't even hear themselves speak. I'd want to get to this other story as well because I think this is the other thing that maybe people might be thinking about this week. And I know we shy away from getting into 2016 horse race stuff, but the truth is that it's coming up pretty soon. I mean, it really is. Like, now it actually is.
Listen, we don't play around with that 2016 malarkey. That's for the lamestream media. But let's get serious for a minute, folks. We need some of that that ratings grab too.
It's coming, man. Actually, probably doesn't help our ratings to talk about it. I mean, you know, look, but look, the reality is that two.
I'm just joking.
No, I know, I hear you, but I'm just saying, like, you know, it's before you know it, 2015, and we're going to be completely immersed in all this Michigas. And you know, watching what 2016 is right around the corner, and watching what Hillary Clinton is saying is actually an important barometer to see if there's any hope of. Not her being an actual progressive, not the Democratic Party establishment really having a significant shift, but the ability to influence and anticipate and potentially alter what might happen. And look, I have to say, Hillary Clinton, from going to Goldman Sachs and saying that you shouldn't be demonized, disclaiming that she left the White House dead broke, has been astonishing to me in her tone deafness. And her comfort with Wall Street power, which is obviously profoundly and seriously undermining this country. But one area that she's recently made waves on, she came out in an interview with Jeffrey Goldberg and criticized President Obama directly on his foreign policy. And, you know, look, Obama said his foreign policy doctrine is don't do stupid stuff. And frankly, I understand the appeal of that mentality, because the obsession in Washington and the obsession with a certain type of foreign policy mandarin to create these strategic and intellectual frameworks, which either in the case of the neocons and the Bush administration are, when implemented, profoundly dangerous and destructive, or in other cases, just some sort of intellectual packaging around basically preordained policies and reactions to events. Obama has shied away from that. And I think, look, Obama's foreign policy, there's many areas, drones, really not dealing with some of the underlying causes of terrorism, not thinking strategically about reengaging diplomacy. There's many, many, many areas that you could seriously criticize him on. And I do, and he should be. And he has not been a transformative president in foreign policy. He hasn't, you know, hasn't generally been a transformative president. But negotiations with Iran, generally being more skeptical about applying heavy military power to situations, even as he has done so. But the reality is that compared to the alternatives in both the Democratic and certainly Republican parties, he has been much less aggressive in going that path. I mean, people completely misread Syria. He brought himself into a box by saying chemical weapons were a red line. So then when they were used by the Assad government, his credibility was put on the line, and he needed to respond to that. Now, I still spoke out forcefully against military action in Syria, but I understood the thought process, and the idea that he was jonesing for military action in Syria is just not a rational reading of any of his moves that he made in that process. If anything, he was pulling back most of the time. He was pulling back from arming insurgents. He was pulling back from any type of military action. And when the deal came through with Russia, he jumped on that deal. And he took it. So that's the reality. It's a guy who's willing to do some pretty bold things on Iran. He was willing to attempt a reset with Russia. And the reason for the failures of that are absolutely not just the United States' fault. Again, if you're looking at it realistically. And he has attempted to manage the world in a more rational way. Not necessarily a humane way at all, but certainly a more rational way. And I think he deserves credit for that. Put arms control back on the agenda as an example. Now, Hillary has come out and she said, don't do stupid stuff is not a foreign policy doctrine. And she said, quote, great nations need organizing principles, and don't do stupid stuff is not an organizing principle. And then she went on and she criticized him strongly for not arming the opposition in Syria, which, again, obviously, it's a very complex question about what the right answer to that was. And then she also basically gave – I mean, again, with Gaza, Obama and the administration has voiced a lot of support for Israel, which any administration is going to do. That's the reality of the political dynamics. But he has personally said he feels bad for the people of Gaza. John Kerry has made his frustration very clear. And, you know, the State Department spokesperson called the shelling on a UN school reprehensible, I believe the word was. Now, that shouldn't be exceptional or surprising at all in any type of sane world. But it's not a sane world, so it is exceptional and surprising. Now, this is what Hillary said about what's happening in Gaza. I think Israel did what it had to do to respond to Hamas rockets. Israel has a right to defend itself. The steps Hamas has taken to embed rockets in command and controlled facilities and tunnel entrances in civilian areas, this makes the response by Israel difficult. Now, again, response by Israel difficult. I'm not discounting that Hamas poses some type of threat, but the reality is that there is nothing difficult about the most powerful military in the region that has complete control over the Palestinian population choosing to exercise the restraint to not kill over 1,000 civilians. There's nothing complex about that. And not only is Hillary Clinton showing all of the foreign policy instincts and all of the foreign policy mistakes that led to her supporting the invasion of Iraq, which was precisely the opening that allowed President Obama to beat her in the Democratic primary, she's also giving, you know, she's opening another threshold, because this is the bullshit that opens the door. Not necessarily for Rand Paul. Rand Paul has too many problems. He's not a credible candidate. He's all of the racial stuff, all of the crackpottery. He's not particularly good on his feet. He's going to be easy to knock out. But if the Democratic establishment and Hillary Clinton keeps going back to the foreign policy failures and the foreign policy cliches of the previous decades, like they're still living out the trauma of losing the McGovern campaign, that poses a serious danger to their link to younger voters, because younger voters are not interested in this stuff. They're actually very interested in foreign policy, and they're very interested in engaging in the world, and they want to engage in the world in a smart way. They want to solve actual problems. And these cliches and needs for meta strategies and all of this are not speaking to them. And I think what's astonishing for Hillary Clinton, and I say this as someone who's really very agnostic about her, I don't dislike her personally. I don't have big kind of – look, she's a Democratic establishment politician, okay? That means that by the time she has breakfast, she's probably done many things that I pretty fundamentally disagree with. But I don't think – you know, I think there's things to admire about her. I think she's very smart. I think it's absolutely worth noting that as a woman, what she's accomplished and what she's done. And it would be very significant to have the first woman president. Obviously, I'd prefer that woman to be Elizabeth Warren, but this is what's on tap. But it is astonishing to me that in an era when we're done and serious about inequality and about the power of finance, she's flat-footed and wrong on those things. And in an era when people are truly fed up with the foreign policy failures and the foreign policy cliches that have governed things for the last couple of decades, maybe more extremely under George W. Bush, but across the board, that Hillary Clinton is still so intellectually locked in them makes her like a candidate from 1990, 1992, 1984, running in a 2016 election. And not only is that an electoral problem, that's an incredible problem for all of us, because we can't take this kind of governance anymore. That is fundamentally off base. That doesn't say, how do we actually solve this problem in Israel-Palestine? No more cliches. That doesn't worry about coming up with the right slogan for a meta strategy, but really worries about, what does a world look like with complete imbalance of corporate power? How do we govern technology in the 21st century? How do we actually deal with climate change? And yes, how do we deal with terrorism? But how do we deal with the root causes of terrorism? And the same conversations and the same cliches and the same repetitions are not going to get us where we need to go. And it's very disturbing to me that even someone as smart and as ambitious and as capable as Hillary Clinton is just using the opportunity to knock President Obama for being cautious, which frankly, given all the alternatives, I'm going to prefer. So this needs to be called out very early and very quickly, because she probably will be the nominee. If she wants it, I don't see who could take her out. And we are getting to an exhaustion point of policy failure. And she's talking a point, and again, it's not personal to her at all. She had a good agenda. I think she could govern quite effectively. But she seems so wedded. And this is the really important point too. It's not just a question of, you know, yes, her campaign contributions being politically compromised by special interests and all that. That's absolutely true. But when you read something like this, you realize like there is an intellectual compromise. There's the phrase is cognitive capture. And we need to figure out some way of breaking out of it. I'm not sure how, but it's astonishing to me that this interview could take place in 2014 without some rethink. Okay, we have a little bit more time left. We're going to switch. Matt is going to make this switch. I guess if you're listening to the podcast, this doesn't really matter to you visually, but you're not going to hear anybody for a few seconds. So
yeah,
we're just
switching so we can get the video going, because these will all be clipped and put on YouTube.
These will all be clipped and put on, which you should be watching. All right, we'll be right back, folks.
Back. My name is Matt Binder.
I am Michael Brooks.
We're doing this with the headphones. Without the headphones, there's no guests. We don't get any sound. All of our stories are just, us telling you what's going on. So I don't think I've ever done the show without headphones. It's just a weird feeling. You know what I mean?
I know.
Let's get to this, because I wanted to bring this up. Because I thought it was pretty interesting.
What is it?
That Ukraine email. Here we go. So we got an email the other day from from a listener, and the headline of the email from listener Dwayne was, "Why are you avoiding this story?" Now, we received this email on August 10th, 2014. As we record this, it is the August 11th, 2014. It's a Monday. We don't do the show Sunday. So we really weren't avoiding it. It just wasn't possible.
Don't distract from the issue, man.
I mean, because the email sends us to an article that was also posted on August 10th, 2014. But I guess we are avoiding it, Michael. We should have jumped.
I don't know
on
why
it.
Are we even talking about this. I was trying to avoid it.
Oh, that's true. What we should have done, I'm disappointed in us, what we should have done is I should have called you on Sunday. And we should have rushed into the office on our day off and covered this story.
I know.
But basically, it's a copy and paste from what it looks like. Is it New York Times? No, it's – what is it? Consortium –
It's a retelling of a New York Times report, which if you read the original New York Times report, it's, it's not exactly an exact representation of the report.
And it's basically about – the Consortium News version, like
consortium,
you said.
Yeah, the Perry, Robert Perry.
Yeah, his version of the report, of him covering the New York Times report, was New York Times discovers Ukraine's neo-Nazis at war. Now, we have covered this. We've covered this a lot. In fact, when we were covering the Euromaidan protests, the main thing in terms of the frame of what we talked about it in was many times about the neo-Nazis who are co-opting this movement.
We talked to Professor Serhii Blocki. I always say this a million times because he's a really prominent Ukraine expert. And he said there are three different factions of these protests. There is a left, or actually four, basically. There's a left. There are compromised opposition parties that are more pro-Europe but have all the similar problems with corruption and everything else. Then there are liberal pro-Europeans, and then there is a far-right neo-fascist strain. And those are all four parts of this movement, and that the government of the previous government is corrupt, autocratic, and brutal. And when they unleash violence on the protesters, even if there are some people protesting that are really terrible, you got to support them.
There you go.
Simple.
Simple as that. And I know why this is sent to us. Because we've heard about it from all of the weird left-wing conspiracy theorists who are the most baffling to me when it comes to Russia and Ukraine and the United States and the Russian separatist rebels. It's super baffling to me. Like, I am always just amazed at the different things that come out. They send the links to RT, which I would just like to say, RT covers some things great. Every news organization, every outlet out there has their specialties. When it comes to covering stories that involves Russia itself, RT is not a good source.
Look, it's, using RT to do a Russia or Ukraine story is like the equivalent of someone mailing us, "You don't understand tax policy. Here's a link to Fox Business." I'm sorry. It's just, it's ridiculous.
It's like taking the sheriff's version of events whenever his county police shoots an unarmed black teen. It's like taking the U.S. government's official position on a drone strike as what happens over the family in Yemen who saw with their own eyes their own family members being obliterated from the sky.
Well, and also, but let's just get really quickly to the substance of the article, because I read the original New York Times piece.
Yes.
And I read Perry's representation of it. Look, Robert Perry is a guy who I'm aware he did some great reporting in the 1980s, okay? Like, you know, the bands put out great music in the 1980s. They're pretty horrible today, some of them, all right? Like, I don't, you know, okay, I get it. He did some great work. But his reporting today in Syria, which again, as I said, really upfront, I know Syria much better than Ukraine.
Yes.
His Syria reporting is garbage. So if that's any indication of his Ukraine reporting, it's also garbage. And what the New York Times report said is that there are factions in the pro-Ukrainian government at this point side and militia groups connected to it that have neo-fascist leanings, maybe
yes.
even neo-Nazi.
Yes.
And they're engaging in human rights abuses. Now, first of all, my response would be I never, and Matt, never – We've said three really simple things, which we'll just repeat again. Those protests were not staged, managed coup plots by the National Endowment for Democracy. They were genuine uprisings
yes.
that included some very bad people. And you know what? Yes. When massive movements like that happen,
different groups jump in.
And different groups, well, and governments are interested, and governments plot strategy,
and they co-opt
it. And the Americans do that, and the Europeans do that. That's how the world works. But it was not like concocted. This was not like Iran and Mossadegh. That's just not established. It's not established. Then number two, we said that the Russian foreign policy with regard to Ukraine is like a Monroe Doctrine style foreign policy. It's trying to bully and control its own neighborhood. We've seen this in many, and they want their preferred client state in power. It's as simple as that. And that's why they invaded Crimea. And maybe a lot of Crimeans wanted it. Maybe some Crimeans didn't. But that's just the reality. That's why they invaded. And that's why they're backing militia groups, which did, when this conversation came up again, they knocked out the Malaysia
yes.
plane out of the sky. Not because they were trying to intentionally knock down a
they did it,
passenger
but
jet.
It was,
but
yeah.
But they were getting heavy artillery from Russia, and they did it. And then the third thing the third thing we'll say again, which is that our interest has been solidarity and an accurate reporting. There's always two missions that I have. I'm running longer than I want to do, but there's always two missions. Number one, who is the left and the people who are genuinely trying to create a more inclusive and just society?
Mm-hmm.
Who are they and what are they trying to do? I want to be in solidarity with them. And then number two, a clean, accurate, hopefully somewhat complex presentation of the situation.
Yes.
That's
yes.
all I've been
exactly.
trying to do. That's it. And that includes that I'm – of course, the parties in this current Ukrainian government – although, again, when they went out and voted, fascist parties got about 1% of the vote.
Yeah.
So this is – or maybe 2%, but nowhere near some overwhelming majority. Does this government engage in human rights abuses? I have no doubt. Do they have problematic oligarchic policies too? I have no doubt. That wasn't the point, and that was never what we were arguing.
Exactly. And I'm just bringing it up to close it out
yes, yes.
because you can be 100% against the fascist parts of the Ukraine militia groups, the Ukraine government, whatever. You could be 100% against them. And at the same time – now listen to me carefully, conspiracy theorists – be against Russia once again having a strong arm over Ukraine and its people. It's that simple.
It's not really that complicated.
It's that simple.
I also have to say again, guys, like, look, I don't want to get like into like the Fidel Castro or Chavez debates, and but I will say this. Even as I don't condone those guys for things that they have done, I understand why, as a leftist, you would want them to succeed and you would be intrigued what they were trying to do. I get that. Vladimir Putin is a far-right nationalist who uses religion and xenophobia to – he's like – he has the social politics of Pat Buchanan, the human rights record of any other – you know, I can't think of a handy example, but a brutal – social politics of Pat Buchanan – human rights record of a brutal autocrat in that region, and has basically, frankly, followed the economic policies of Thomas Friedman and Davos. Russia has one of the highest inequality rates in the world, and it's a petrostate. So I don't even understand, like, this guy – and if your politics is really just as simple as if they oppose the U.S., you support them, then your politics are completely impoverished and stupid.
But Putin doesn't like Obama. He's not a United States right-winger. And he looks manly on a horse. So when it comes down to it –
you have the symmetry with the right there.
Yep. All right. Let's end on this. Like I said, we are recording this on Monday, August 11th. It's the evening. And about an hour and a half, 2 hours ago, the news broke that comedian and actor – Robin Williams passed away. Very sadly, it seems to be suicide. His agent said he was battling severe depression recently. Very sad. But in celebration of his life, and as a comedian, I'm sure he'd want us to have a good old laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the life and career of Robin Williams, Michael.
You know, I was definitely – I would say – you know what I would say for me was I think about Robin Williams. I like how much – the fact that he really was not like my kind of comedian per se. Like he wasn't the usual type that I would gravitate towards. And the fact that how he just was hilarious. It didn't matter that that wasn't like my thing.
He was probably one of the funniest people in the comedy scene in Hollywood, in movies.
I think of Good Morning
Television.
Vietnam.
I'm going thinking through some of the movies right now that I love him in. Hook.
Yeah.
Is an amazing movie where he plays a grown-up Peter Pan who forgot about Neverland. And it's a fantastic film. He's the genie in Aladdin, which to me is one of the greatest Disney roles of all time. I mean, he was able to I know they say a lot of the best cartoons are geared towards kids but have humor that only adults understand. Mm. But Disney doesn't always do that. At least at that time they didn't. And he did with the genie. He was able to – and I'm sure a lot of that was off the cuff for him and just improvisational – because he was that funny. I think Death to Smoochie. Have you ever seen that movie?
You know, I actually missed that movie, which I know I need to see. Everybody tells me that.
To me, it's one of the most underrated movies ever. When it came out, I remember critics saying how bad it was. And I didn't see it in the movies. And then my dad is watching it, and he tells me, you have to watch this movie. This was years ago, like when it first started being shown on cable. And I watched it, and I was like, how did this movie get bad? This is one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. I mean, how do you go wrong with the movie starring Robin Williams, Danny DeVito, and Edward Norton? I mean, how do you go wrong with that?
It sounds pretty hard. I'll tell you a movie like which was not just like objectively, it's not a very good movie. But there's this movie called Cadillac Man. I think it's this really obscure Robin Williams movie, and it's sort of like there's something about he plays this kind of like sleazy Cadillac dealer and. The dealership gets taken over by Tim Robbins, actually. Tim Robbins is in it. And he's all upset because, like, he's the boyfriend of one of the girls who's, like, a secretary there or something, and she's cheating on him. And he shows up with a machine gun and takes them hostage. And Robin Williams, like, his character basically kind of, like, deals with the situation and saves it. And, you know, even in that role, he's, like, he's playing this guy who's really, like, an asshole, but he just has this, like, goodness about him. He's a good dude. He's got a lot of empathy.
Yeah.
And I just remembered that role because, again, it's really not – I don't even know why I watched it. It's not such a great movie. But it's like there was – because, you know, the reason I didn't turn a channel was just because there's something compelling about him. Like the way he's trying to connect with Tim Robbins, the way he's trying to like really do right by people even as he's like clearly really struggling and obviously tragically like we see. You know, he's obviously really struggling. It's just something very palpable about him. And came through in his comedy, came through in his – I mean, I also know, you know, he wasn't always – I think he went in and out of it a little bit, but he clearly, you know, he had liberal politics and spoke out on issues like – you know, he was a guy like, you know, too. Like he spoke out on like, as an example, like rights for gays and lesbians.
Yes.
Long before that became like, you know, just the sort of like go-to thing that you do if you're like an acceptable human being in certain coastal cities. I mean, he did that at a point when – it could have hurt him at a box office. He played a gay man and a cross-dresser when it could have hurt him at the box office. And, you know, so he definitely had a real social conscience. He's obviously a really sensitive and talented person. And, yeah, it's sad. It's just really sad.
I mean, Miss Doubtfire.
Miss Doubtfire.
Great movie. Yeah. What else do we got here? I want to make sure we really – I mean, Good Morning Vietnam, obviously. He was Popeye.
He was Popeye. Right?
Yeah, people don't remember that one. It's one of his first movies. Of course, I mean, we all were introduced to him with Mork and Mindy, great television show. I mean, would that show have gotten anywhere without him?
You know, I mean, don't even remember it, but I couldn't imagine.
I mean, he literally, with his it's Jumanji, Toys, Patch Adams. I could just go on. Bicentennial Man. A one-hour photo. I mean, this guy was able to not just play a hilarious comedy role, but when it was got down to him having to play a serious, dramatic role where he had to be just a weird, creepy antagonist.
Yes.
He was able. Man, could he act. Like,
yeah, he really
could. Dude was amazing. And I want to end this today's show by giving you this number. If you or anyone you know is suffering from depression, please call 1-800-273-8255. That's the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. 1-800-273-8255. It's easy when you know a friend, especially if you're a young person, or you know what, not even just a young person. I'm just saying especially because I know myself. It was easier when I was young when a friend would say they're depressed. I'd be like, oh, come on, man. Let me make you laugh and you can get over it. And you know, as you get older, you realize that's not what depression really is all about. It's not about just getting over it. It's not about having a laugh, getting yourself, you know, to think about happy things. It's just something that's not that simple. It's a disease. It's something you have to fight. And I think it's important for people to know that, you know, people care about you. And if you're feeling this way, there's people out there who can help you. And please do help yourself by calling this number, 1-800-273-8255. If you are depressed, reach out. Robin Williams, thank you for all the great movies. I'm glad I went to Comedy Cellar that night many years ago in about maybe it was like 2009, 2010, when he just randomly showed up.
Oh, wow.
Cut Jim Norton's set short, which really...
Best of all worlds.
And... and did probably the greatest set I was ever seen. I was right in front. He was about an inch away from me. Hour-long set, I would say it was. And it was definitely the funniest thing I've ever seen. And it wasn't pre-written punchline joke humor. Dude was able to just talk about life, and he was fucking hilarious.
That's great. And I also just want to say right before we wrap up, and I hope everybody's having a great vacation and everything, but since we're not going to be here, to whatever comments people make on Fox or conservative radio shows about depression or suicide or Robin Williams, Fangul, F-U.
Michael's doing the old...
Yeah, I'm giving you that. I just want to say
the old full-blooded Italian.
Just so that's covered in the event of...
I'm already seeing it, but I'm not...
I don't want to cite any specific examples. I just want to give a general F-U. Let's remember him. And, yeah, I think that's beautiful that Matt did that. Reach out for help. Everybody needs it at some point.
And we will end. We will end with a bangarang. Take care.
Bye, everybody.
Oh, we will be back on Wednesday. Great shows throughout the week. I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the Nets are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you?